Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Context Podcast. This is your host, Kate Langsdorf. This is the first time we've done this in a long while, and I am so excited to be joined here by Roger Q. Mason. Roger,
hello.
Hi. You are being such a guinea pig right now because this is our first time in the Seattle studio, which is to say I'm recording from my bed, but with a microphone and everything. And you've been lovely with my tech issues, and I am so glad you're here. And tell me where you're recording from.
So I'm recording from Los Angeles, California. I am here in LA. I was born and raised in LA. And so I'm one of those rare breeds known as a native Angeleno. This grand city, a city of transplants and westward dreams, a city of forgetting, as they call it, from time to time. And yet here I am, you know, a native of this place.
And where in LA were you raised?
Well, I this is a very important story to tell, actually. I was born by the sea. And what I mean by that is that I was born in Santa Monica, California in the mid 80s. And I think it's important for me to say that to people because LA, amongst many other things, is a town that historically has thrived on what I call geographical bias. And really, what if you want to be real estate apartheid, frankly.
Right.
And which has now become class-based apartheid. But, you know, the connection between class and race are always so gooey and mushy and problematic. So when I was growing up in the 80s and the 90s, and I'd say to people, I'm from Santa Monica, they would be very confused and taken aback because there was, at the time, a certain image of who was from Santa Monica, what they looked like, what they talked like, how they sounded. And there was a sense of cultural eligibility. Mm. Some people were and were not culturally eligible to claim that they were from Santa Monica. But you can check my birth certificates, honey. I'm from there. And, you know, and I have a long association with Santa Monica. I was raised in Koreatown. Went to school at Pilgrim School, which is somewhere between Koreatown and downtown in LA. But I always maintained that I was born in Santa Monica because I wanted to telegraph to folks from minute one, you don't know about me.
So people who are listening can't see you. Can you tell me what the image is of Santa Monica and what people were seeing with you and what that contrast was?
Right. Well, so first of all, I'm Black, Irish, and Filipinx, and so I look Samoan, or a Dominican on certain days, when the
hair, depending on the sunlight.
Depending on the sunlight and the haircut. Uh-huh. But that's certainly not the image of Santa Monica of that time. The image of Santa Monica at the time was cisgender, white, you know, middle income. And actually, at the time when my family started, one, investing in property management in Santa Monica, and two, when I was born there, the generation was shifting. So there was an older generation that had been there from about the 50s or 60s that was kind of aging, dying out, moving back with their families. Mm-hmm. And then new venture capitalists and new small-time real estate folks were coming in and buying up these properties. So the demographic was changing. But old habits, especially that grand habit called bias, those habits die very hard. And so the image that's propagated of Santa Monica is, you know, blondies on the beach. Mm-hmm. That was certainly the case at that time, although now I believe it has shifted. But for somebody to say in the late 80s or early 90s, I'm from Santa Monica, and you're brown and sticking around, was a bit of an anomaly. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of folks, it allowed them to understand that my family, my background, were going to belie all of the stereotypes and typical understandings that they thought they knew as true. In my case, I was here to dispute them and disrupt them. And that, I believe, has become my mantra, not only as a person, but also as an artist. How do I take the status quo, dispute, disrupt, and transform it through cultural dialogue and dramaturgical engagement? How do I use this form that we call theater, theatron, the seeing play, something that you never dreamed or something that you were conditioned not to see?
We got a little bit of a glitch for a second for
In 80 million mailboxes across the USA,
the census is coming to help us plan the way.
Help your community get equal government representation and help show where funds are needed for job programs, new schools, parks, better health care, and more. Answer the 1980 census.
And all your answers are kept confidential by law.
Welcome back, folks. We had some technical difficulties, but Roger was telling a real good story about being from Santa Monica and having people not believe you. Does that seem accurate?
It's not necessarily that people didn't believe me. What I was saying was at the time there was propagated a certain image or understanding of who was eligible to be from the west side of town.
Mm-hmm.
And so my family and I did not fit the traditional model of that description. And what I was saying earlier was that I have made it my mission to telegraph to people that what they think they know or what the status quo has told them to know of me and my family and how we're defined and what our prescribed place is in the civic and socioeconomic latitude and longitude of it all is not what you think it is. And so it has become my mission, both as a person and also as an artist, to question, refute, and reestablish how we define who belongs where and what they and what that belonging looks like.
This is one of my personal pet peeves, because I'm also from Los Angeles. My grandma was born in Hollywood in 1925.
Right.
My parents moved to Orange County, and then that's where I grew up, and then I moved back to LA. But when people would ask me where I was from, I'd say I'm from around here. They'd be like, no, but like, where are you from? Like,
right.
Well, like, no, but like around here for like 100 years or so.
Right.
But for me, it's because I'm fat. And they're like, no, but you're not wow. what LA looks like. So
right.
like, well, what part of the Midwest were you born in? Like, no, I'm from here. Right. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that people have very limited visions and limited scopes of understanding of where people come from and what they look like and how they're supposed to comport themselves. And I think when those of us outside of those visions come into view for folks, we're doing very important cultural work, because we are helping to define and redefine what's possible within certain social spaces. And I actually think that it's necessary. I actually believe that our presence, just as we are, is essential to social growth, because we are chipping away systematically at those cultural systems that limit the scope of possibility for people.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that the work we're doing, just by being ourselves, all you have to do is wake up in the morning and exist
mm-hmm.
as you are. And by doing that, you are changing the fabric of visibility and identity politics. I truly and firmly believe that that is what is going on, and that is what's necessary. And a lot of walls are broken down because of that. And if you can hone it and you can mobilize that identity, you can really do some transformative work.
I love it. That's inspiring, because I know sometimes it's hard to just, like, in LA in particular, just wake up and be yourself. At least that's the experience
just
that I've
up
had.
Myself. How can I get up in the morning and be unapologetically, unequivocally me? Mm-hmm. And not be swayed or made to feel inferior or discouraged in any way by any forces, both close to me, on the internet, on the television screens, on no place. How can I stand firm and hold true to my authentic self? That's hard work. Mm-hmm. That takes a certain kind of spiritual endurance and firmness of constitution that has to be honed and mastered and nourished despite impediments, id est the world. Mm-hmm. We must do that work because we have to stand tall and remain ourselves, because if we don't, we won't be able to move the culture forward. Or as Taylor Mack says, we won't be able to dream the culture forward.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk more about your work. So you are a playwright, and your people. I don't know if it was your publicist or who, but your people.
I got to plug her. My publicist and the producer of my a theater company. Well, we do some TV film stuff now as well, but my production company is called Pearl Street Productions, and my publicist and producer's name is Nastasia Cordero, and she and I have known each other since we were 12 years old. And so if anybody knows this journey of my firming of constitution that we're talking about, mm-hmm. she's been along for the ride this whole time from 12 years old till now, which is in excess of 20 years. So she was actually the one that contacted you.
Oh, that is so lovely. I love that you've known her since you were 12. Those are such important working relationships.
Yeah.
So she got a hold of me to book you, because you're one of the first people I've had on, not the very first, but one of the first who wasn't already like a dramaturgy buddy.
Yeah.
And so I was told that you had a play about gay Abraham Lincoln. All I needed to be completely sold.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Yeah, so
I had no further questions. I'm like, great. When can we do this?
Well, let me tell you. So she was talking about my play. It's called Lavender Men. And it's a piece about Lincoln's queer relationship with his legal assistant, Elmer Ellsworth. But the key to the play is that it's not a straightforward sort of gay fantasia, as they used to call them, mm-hmm. And still do. It's narrated by this picaresque narrator called Taffeta. And Taffeta is on her own journey towards visibility and inclusion, because Taffeta is a queer plus size person of color and is sort of haunted by all of the men that have looked past her. And she's in communion with these two who feel invisible and misconstrued in their own ways, mm-hmm. in their own time, and stuck in the, you know, the purgatory, the limbo. And so they go on this journey together to try and rewrite a story that may or may not have happened. And then they can't rewrite the unwritten story. So it's multiple layers of narrative, but ultimately what they come to at the end is that they have to have a purging. They have to shed all of the stories and all of the identities and all of the expectations of themselves and of each other that hold them to the fixed positions in which they're seen societally. And so the play, after this ritual of trying to change the story, the play ends with a burning of all the costumes, mm-hmm. Which represent all the different roles that they've played, literal roles, but also thematically and symbolically, the roles of, you know, what it means to be a plus size person, what it means to be made invisible, what it means to be trapped in a certain vision of masculinity. Lindy, all of these different things. We put them in the pyre, and then we light them aflame at the end of the play. And so the play is about watching the old world turn to embers so that a new one can emerge.
Talk to me about the pronouns in the play. And also, we right before we started recording, we were talking about your own pronouns. But can you say you were explicit about who Taffeta is?
Yes.
In the stage
directions. So I call Taffeta, I use she, her pronouns for Taffeta for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's an homage to the girls, to the legendary children, to the camp and the queer aesthetic. But second of all, I think that for us creating the play, it's important to sort of destabilize what we think we see and what we think we know. So I call her she because I find her energy to be very feminine. Mm-hmm. I find her energy to be very, very much feminine in the sense that it is fluid and it is pliable, but it's also perseverant. Now, you asked me what my pronouns were in our prep conversations for this podcast episode. And I use he, him pronouns, but I use them very strategically. So you all can hear my voice and you all can hear its tone and its timbre and all of its little nuances and wiles. And so traditionally this tone and style of speaking, and maybe even a lisp, a ghost lisp that I don't even hear, would be interpreted as female, not just feminine, but female. Mm-hmm. So when I was growing up, I'd get on the phone and I'd call, you know, like you'd call information,
right?
411. We're having to take some of your listeners to the pre 5G, 4G, LTE cell phone. We going way back from that to when you'd call the operator of 411. You could call to find out what time it was. There was a number for that. You'd call and find out what your time was in your time zone. Then you had a number to get to find out phone numbers. And when I would get on that phone and phone calls like it, it was, yes, ma'am, how can I help you?
Consistently from a young age?
Always. Now, maybe when I was a little bit younger and the voice hadn't dropped yet, you know, that's understandable. The squeaking sopranos, as they used to call the boy players in Shakespeare, you know, fine. But then the voice never quite dropped past a certain place. So the ma'am and the miss remained. And so in our binary, gender binary world, I had a decision to make, which was, do I embrace this? Or do I feel ashamed or fearful of it? Of course, the world would say, you need to feel ashamed of it. You're a man. Tell them you're a man. But why? Yeah, okay, fine. I am male or male presenting physically. But obviously there are aspects of myself, my gender and identity performance, that register for people as female or feminine or feminized. Mm-hmm. Now, I've had it in person too. I've experienced this. I can walk up. I have literally been in conversations with people that I don't know and had a 5 o'clock shadow and it'll still be ma'am and miss.
Really?
And then they'll have to do a double take. Yes. Yes. So there's something about how people are wired to register gender. Mm-hmm. This is what it looks like. This is what it sounds like. And when you ask them how and why they think you're one or the other, the answer is manifested in a very rudimentary, almost elementary school lexicon. The lexicon is, because, you know, your voice is high, or you can have someone who's very articulate. in other contexts. And yet when you start asking them about how they define and understand and register gender and gender expression, you realize that the cultural growth stopped when they were 10 to 12.
Mm.
So we have a job to do as dramaturgs and as dramatists. We have to help people gain a new vocabulary about gender. Because obviously the current definition doesn't hold. I was so inspired about 3 or 4 years ago when the New York Times came out with 30 some gender definitions. They posted them, the different genders that are possible or that folks have self-identified and reported to either the city or the state of New York.
Ooh, I missed that. I gotta look that up.
This was very interesting and revealing that what we have done to limit and to police gender identity and expression has narrowed people's perspectives and limited how they interact with other people in the world in a deleterious way. So I say he, him, but I do so because I need to help people redefine who can be contained within that gender. I need them to challenge and expand what's possible. And I had a play that went up in July called The White Dress. That was a genderqueer coming of age piece that I wrote, and we'd been working on it for quite some time. It got its premiere at Access Theater in New York.
All right.
And one of the big themes of that play was, how do we define ourselves past the definitions we're given or the definitions we're inherited? And there's a dream sequence at the end, a drag sequence. Of course there is. Because, you know, the characters are so constrained in life, but when they're knocked out cold by the homophobic boyfriend and now we're in dream, we can speak that realness. I remember this character, and I'm going to paraphrase the piece because I don't remember it quite the way I wrote it then, but they were saying, I'm expanding possibilities, you know, and this notion of expanding what a gender can hold and also living outside of it completely. I really firmly believe that that is at least one of the main things that inspires me dramaturgically, is looking at stories that are about the constrictions surrounding gender and sexuality. That's something that I think is so, because it's literally at our core. It literally is. It encompasses the core of our being, both our being and also our physical being, who we are, who we love, who we're attracted to, and how we express it physically and metaphysically. If we can't reconcile that as humans in the world, we're not going to be able to move forward.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this duty as a dramaturg and a dramatist, and I only knew of you as a dramatist. Do you consider yourself to be a dramaturg, or just very dramaturgy friendly?
Well, I consider myself to be both. My undergraduate training, and I never understood it. I never understood it this way until recently when I put my life together and started thinking about what am I doing now? You know, it was sort of the Jesus year. it was the Jesus year. And so I was thinking about where have we come to and where are we going? And my undergraduate education was largely helmed by Michael Cadden, who, of course, was the noted and famed dramaturg at Yale Rep during the Lloyd Richard years, who then went into education. And I was trained to think about plays dramaturgically first, and then later as a dramatist. So literary critique, analysis, structure, how we build the play, not only on the page, but also as a blueprint for a larger event to be manifested in three dimensions and possibly four dimensions, intuition and spirit. These are the types of things that I learned in those early impressionable years of my theatrical training. And so they've never left me. So when I come into the room, I'm speaking to the collaborators, not only as the dramatist, someone that's on the page, but also as someone that has a second set of eyes on the work as a dramaturg. In addition, I have worked as a dramaturg on other people's works. Oh. So, yes. And so I actually think that having that double sight is an important skill to have, because you become, after a point, a great self-editor. Mm-hmm. I think all strong dramatists have a little dramaturg in their head.
Yeah, I think so too.
It's just a matter of whether you listen to them or not. Some folks listen to them, and some folks listen to that dramaturg, and some folks don't. I'm seeking that person out constantly,
right?
You know, when I'm sitting. And, you know, I have to say too, on the subject of process, you know, I'm here working at one of these writers' co-ops, and that's a newer thing to me. I can't work at home. Some people can nestle at home in a corner and do this work, and God bless them. I have to be in a public, private place.
Yeah.
So, you know what I'm saying? Because the hive mind energy feeds our own individual energy. But also, there's a sense of accountability. Even if you don't speak to any of these people, you see them living and striving and making work in the same room. And there's something inspiring and focusing about that.
If they're typing, you got to be typing. Because what if they're getting more work done than you?
If they're shutting up, then you've got to be shutting up. But if they're on looking at NFL on their little study break, then you can go on Out Magazine and look and see who did what to whom.
Right.
You know, that's just what it is. But what has happened here in the last couple of months has been purely magical, because I think like never before, I have had to encounter and be in dialogue with my inner dramaturg. What I mean by that is I still hold firm to the idea that we're not just writing when we're sitting at our computers typing dialogue. First of all, I think that dialogue is the last facet of narrative storytelling. Mm. You know, I believe in what Hitchcock was saying about, you know, you need to have dramatic action and then sprinkle a couple of words on top. Because when I was in high school, I had a drama teacher. His name was Joseph Harper. And he said, acting is someone doing something somewhere. He didn't say someone saying something. Mm-hmm. He said someone doing something. I think ultimately what we have to remember is that we come to the theater to see dramatic action. And so first is action. What are they doing? How are they doing it? Who are they allying with and fighting against in order to do it? Now, is dialogue one of the tools that can be used towards achieving that goal? Yes. Is it the only one? Absolutely not. And more importantly than that, what character role does place, space, circumstance play in this piece? So that's the dramaturg, mm-hmm. You know. The dramaturg is sitting in the room with me asking. I used to believe, and I still believe this quite a bit, that you can discover so much about a piece, not by sitting and typing, but one, living in the world, and also being in collaboration with other people, meaning workshopping. And I normally like to get to workshop fairly early in a process.
Yeah.
But what I've learned recently is that I may have wanted to get to workshop a little bit earlier because I didn't want to sit with my inner dramaturg long enough. And I was looking for the hive mind to help me do the work that I needed to sit in existential unknowing for myself a little bit longer. And so I became one of those writers sits before their computer and broods and thinks and contemplates and workshops internally, sits down. I handwrite. I'll handwrite it three or four different times in three or four different ways so that I can feel a certain corporeal investment, you know. And then out of that, I find the one that strikes me and hits me. Now that's newer. Before I'd try one and say, all right, let's bring it into the room and then let's talk through the others. Now, Michael Cadden, I remember, and this is a lesson that he shared with me, what, more than 10 years ago, and I'm just now understanding it. But this is the benefit of the Jesus year, you see. He said, you know, you can talk about a play till you talk yourself out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he said that to me when I was 20, talking through a play instead of sitting down and workshopping and trying. And I said, yeah, okay, blah, 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 blah. You know, I'm 33 now and just figured out what the hell that man was saying. Really understood it. But you know what it is? It's how do we sit gracefully in what we don't know? I think the greatest lesson that a playwright can learn and internalize is how to embrace discomfort and the unknown. Not run away from it, not even combat it. Just sit. We're here now. That's okay. We're going to get through it. We're going to work it. And what are the tools that we have? You know? I think that to me has been one of the most important lessons and discoveries, certainly of this year. Maybe I learned it before, but it registered now, but right. I certainly feel it now.
You know, it's something that I noticed
in a new way.
When I was reading Lavender Men from my perspective, I worked at Ford's Theater in the education department for, you know, about 7 years, including in the museum and everything. And then also a dramaturg. So that script in particular, the thing that struck me was how, I guess I'd describe it as how dramaturgically clean it was. Even though there was so much that was, you know, what we would have at some point called a fantasia element to it.
Yeah.
I thought it did a really good job of setting up, here are some true things. Here are some speculative things. Here are some themes sort of that weave in the middle. But there was no point was I ever, as a reader, I was never confused about where we were in reality versus, like, it seemed very grounded while also being magical.
Yeah.
And so I could tell that you had... that you're thoughtful about these things. I really appreciate that.
You brought up something really interesting, which is Ford's Theater. And I used to haunt Ford's Theater every year for many years because I have been, as maybe you can tell, obsessed with the mythos of Lincoln and all things surrounding him. And So Lavender Men is part of a trilogy of plays.
Oh.
And the other two plays are shorter, so they're not as easily programmed. Mm-hmm. One of them is what I call a beatnik rant. I was working for some time with Murray Mednick at his company, Padua Playwrights, and he's fabulous. And if you call him a playwright, he'll slap you from here to Sunset Boulevard and back. You call him a poet because he's interested in the potency of concise but well-curated language and how it moves kinetically through the body. For you, you translate it as dramatic action. But for him, he's presenting you with a text. You figure out how to activate it. That piece was Booth. And I've talked about that piece a couple of times because it was a dramaturgical turning point for me. Because before that time, everything was so, was a little bit more polite, you know. Everything on the page was very cerebral. And then Booth, I wrote Booth because it was I was preparing for a show at the Hollywood Fringe Festival, and this rant came out of me, you know, of John Wilkes Booth sitting at, you know, in that barn where he was hiding from the Union Army in Port Royal, Virginia, mm-hmm. and he was contemplating whether he was going to surrender or not. And he just turns to the audience like he's Miles Davis and starts cussing the fuck out the belligerence that led to freedom of linguistics coming out of that piece was a huge step forward for me. And then, so then that was the first play in the series. Then the second play was about Elizabeth Keckley. And
oh, I love her.
Yeah, we love her. And they used to have a walking tour that was associated with the Ford, but they canceled her track,
yes.
as I understood it.
I was one of the tour managers for that.
Were you?
Yes. I mostly was the tour manager. My first job at Ford's was to be the tour manager for the Detective McDevitt tour, which was, you know, following around the detective who was like trying to solve the mystery of who all was involved. And then the Elizabeth Keckley tour came on, and I was like, I was sort of the backup person for when the regular person couldn't do it. But I loved that tour, and I loved Jennifer Nelson, who wrote it.
Jennifer Nelson, that's right.
Yeah, and Danielle Drakes, who played Elizabeth Keckley, is a fantastic actress who I want to, and lovely too, P.S., really just a delight to work with.
I have to tell you, you and I might have interfaced, because I remember writing to the staff of the Ford to get the script for that walking. And so at some point in time, 5 or 6 years ago, my letter or series of letters might have come across your desk, because somebody did mail me that script eventually. And I was, because I was doing research for this Keckley play. And so that piece was called Lizzie. And it was sort of her journey to freedom from Mary. So Mary, the circumstance was that Mary was at the St. Denis Hotel and was waiting to hear back from Lizzie how much money she'd made from this old clothes auction, the famous mm-hmm. old clothes auction where she tried to sell memorabilia to gain some income because she was a spendthrift and had used all her husband's pension. Mm-hmm. And Keckley comes back and says, well, honey, didn't nobody buy no clothes? They don't want your old rags, but here's some money from this tell-all book, you know, and I'm talking about behind the scenes, her autobiography. And then the piece ends up becoming a battle royale of two women fighting to be independent in a system where, for various reasons, they're dependent, not only on men, but on reputation and on each other. And that piece, it was sort of a chamber drama. It was a chamber drama with some ritual elements. So because it was a chamber drama and it was more hyper-realist, that was the one that got programmed a couple more times. Mm-hmm. But because it was a one act, and you know, there's only like two or three opportunities for one acts in the world.
Right.
You know, because we don't do those as much. It hasn't had quite the life that I would have wanted it to have, because it stands at about 35-40 minutes, but it is a complete thought. It's just a one act. So then I was threatening to write the third play. Uh-huh. I was threatening to write the third piece, and I couldn't make myself do it. I couldn't bring myself to do it for years until I was in Chicago. And I was at Northwestern's MFA program, and I started writing the Lincoln scenes. So the Lincoln scenes were the play before. And then I had a little frame. There was this narrator that said, oh, honey, you don't know about these two. Boom, disappear, go through the Lincoln scenes, and then comes back at the end, did some little ditty or whatever it was. And I came back to LA and was part of Skylight Theater's writers group. And they said, oh, no, you can't do us like that. You can't have no narrator come here and, you know, give us a little button at the beginning and the end. You got to stop bullshitting us. Come on and give us some stuff. So I started writing. So then I found that. So then I found that neo vaudeville thing in the beginning.
Yeah.
The thing that where they come out in the ether and then it's, well, you know what I heard? I heard this and it's just gossip. Because for me, I said, okay, what this scene is it's spilling tea. It's throwing shade and spilling tea. It's the girls talking. It's the lavender men gossiping. And that was sort of the premise, but it's also me introducing those characters, setting the aesthetic rules of the piece. And then deploying them. And so that ended up being a melding of what was learned from Booth in terms of this brashness of language, repetition and revision, the poetry work that folks like Murray Mednick were doing. And then these very personal, intimate, hyper-realist themes. And what has worked for me with that particular piece is that it's just heightened enough to where directors and programmers want to speak to me about it because of the fantasia, but it's also grounded just enough in the hyper-realist scenes that it's familiar and digestible.
Right.
So it's able to strike a balance. Now I have, you know, you mentioned my publicist and my team, and it's very true. There is a team behind the Roger Q. Mason machine and a lot of hands. You know, no one single person writes a play. You know, there's so many people that contribute their time, their attention, their ideas, their energy, their support to writing a play. And so, you know, that piece really is a tribute to all of them. You know, Lovell Holder is somebody, he's directing the Los Angeles production. So I'm supposed to plug some things. So
yeah, plug some things.
Lavender Men is actually receiving its world premiere at Skylight Theater.
Yay! In Los Angeles.
Yes, it's going to be debuting in April 2020. And I will be playing that picaresque.
Will you really? Try to get my ass back out to Los Angeles to see that.
Baby, come down and maybe let's do a second episode live on the scene in Technicolor. Because
I would love that.
Yeah, because I'm coming in doing all kinds of stuff with this. And we have a hell of a team. I must tell you that the generosity and the trust and the freedom that Skylight gives to their writers is bar none. I have felt and continue to feel so supported and appreciated and honored as a writer performer, you know, in that room and with those people. So, but that's going up. But to continue this list of folks, so many people have laid hands on this thing at various times. June Carroll, who's out here, did a reading of it. Jonathan Munoz Crew was always a champion of the piece. I'm thinking, of course, Nas, Nastasia Cordero, my dear friend, Michael Alvarez. The list continues constantly and continues to evolve. So if there's anybody that was missed, as Duke Ellington would say, I love you madly. And, you know, just going off the top of my head. So that's going up. The other thing that's coming up soon is in LA as well. There's a reading of a play of mine called Burns in Their Veins, which is about Pio Pico, who was the last Mexican governor of California before the American annexation, and was trying to develop what I will call a real estate empire without the correct accoutrement, which is being free, white, and 21 in that era and in that time of manifest destiny. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so the piece is about, for me, who gets burned as somebody climbs to the top of the heap. And it's for me a piece about him and his sister, Isadora, both of whom in their ways are trying to find their way in this new California and this new capitalist America. And they burn each other and eventually come back to the fore. And that's stylistically, since we're on a dramaturgy, podcast, I'll say I'm looking at epic theater as a parent text for that particular piece. And the other piece that I'm really excited about that I'm working on, I'm doing this also because I know that there are a lot of literary managers that listen into this podcast. So if y'all are looking for some programming or looking to help an emerging Black Filipinx plus size, I'm checking off all the boxes.
All the boxes, man.
All of your boxes are being checked off by one person, Roger Q. Mason. So if you're looking for something to develop, the piece is currently called Pleasure Men. I'm going to be continuing to workshop a title for it because I don't want it to be confused with Lavender Men, which is the Lincoln play. But at this time, Pleasure Men is a 1920s drag fantasia. It's another fantasia that imagines five of the girls in the back of the kick line, so to speak, who were imprisoned for indecency after the closure of Mae West's 1928 play, The Pleasure Man, which was a big scandal of the time. And she became sort of the poster girl for the morals code enforcement culture of that time. So I've worked on that piece. I did some of the work on it with Fresh Ground Pepper, with my folks, Andrew Neisler and everybody's name is leaving me. I just know Neisler because I'm seeing his mama and him in my head at this retreat. I worked on, there are two Andrews. Hey, Andrew, too. How you doing, baby? And I'm telling you, his last name has escaped me for the moment. But I know you and I see you and I receive you and appreciate the work that we did on this piece there. And then also Pleasure Men was worked on at the Flea Theater with Hook and Eye. Hook and Eye Theater is a devised theater company. In New York, and we did a residency at the Flea where Michael Alvarez came on and did some work on that piece. So that's another one that's available for development or premiere if for those brave so-and-sos interested and excited to take on a project like that. And what we're talking about there is we're talking about the liberation of queer sex and sort of a meditation on freedom. And that's and also, of course, continuing my work on gender roles and redefining gender. So that's what's currently on the roster. And right now, I'm getting ready to get on stage because I'll be up there, as I said, doing Lavender Men.
Yes.
I'll be up there doing Lavender Men. And so I got to get into fighting shape. So I'm going to be joining a CrossFit gym.
Oh, nice.
And
that's an intense looking role from what I was reading. I'm like, that's a lot of burpees for poor
there are burpees. There are burpees involved. There are on stage changes. There's a lot of isometric work because I play a lamp post and a tree and some other crazy shit that I'm just standing in the middle of scenes. And it's just really, really crazy, crazy, crazy times doing that play. But it's fun because this is what I discovered, Kate, in doing this play, because I also play a character in Pleasure Men called Molasses Jones, who's a Harlem queen that ain't gonna sing unless you pay her. And, but what I discovered working on those two plays, Lavender Men and Pleasure Men, was when you write from the perspective of writer-performer, it invigorates the work in a different way because suddenly you really understanding that you are developing a blueprint for an event that has to be manifested in three dimensions. You truly understand that when your ass is on the firing line and up there. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you don't want yourself to look a mess. I mean, the stakes become so much higher for you.
I appreciate that too, because looking at your Lavender Men script, there was so much of it. Really, truly interested to see it in production, because there's so much of it that I'm like, well, that'll be cool. How is the producing organization going to make that action happen on stage? I know they can do it.
Exactly. And I have to say, and this is the interesting thing. I was speaking to a couple of folks in Chicago about the play. Where hyper-realism and dialogue-based work are king. And I am using he, him pronouns in that, because I do feel that a particular strain of hyper-realism is inherently cisgender male and American, mm-hmm. that kind of kitchen sink drama work. And these folks were saying to me, we don't get this kind of script to come across our desk too often. And what it is it's an invitation and a challenge to us to figure out, how do we manifest these things? And I said, my response to them was, I do believe that it is our duty to constantly keep our toolkit sharp. And if we rest on just one modality of storytelling without taking on these problem plays and taking on these challenging works that invite us to innovate, to explore, to take risks, how are we going to move the craft of the theater forward if we don't stretch our bones and take these kinds of risks? Mm-hmm. So my question and my earnest plea to your listeners, particularly your literary managers and your dramaturgs, is when you see scripts like this, which may not have all the solutions written quite so immediately on the page, I implore you to please give folks like me a call, because what we're trying to do is work with you to expand the possibilities of this craft and what it can hold. And I can guarantee you, we had sold out runs of these readings, both in New York on Broadway and in LA, which is how we got this production. There is an audience, and you can take these scripts up the ladder to the producing manager. And folks know this, and I've had some fabulous conversations with lit managers and dramaturgs, and we're all fighting towards building the same theatrical world. But there is an audience for this work. We just have to build it together. And who I have met in the lit community, particularly through this piece, have been really generous spirited and wonderful risk-taking folks. Mm-hmm. And it really, I mean, I say with absolute gratitude that I am so thankful to Gary Grossman and Tony Abbadimarco, because they're the ones who took the first leap, the first, I hope, of many on this piece and pieces like it. You know, my work, and you as a dramaturg know this, my work, everything is not necessarily all clearly laid out on the page so that you know exactly what you're getting. I like to leave some things to chance and leave some things to exploration in the room. Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed is the kinds of phone calls that I'll get, or email responses from lit managers, they're always respectful of what I'm reaching for and what I'm doing. They're always excited. And I've noticed that the rooms that will usually take on the work are the ones that are they're willing to take that leap and that risk with me. And I really do believe there are so many dramaturgs and literary managers that are taking those leaps and that are doing that work. And I'm excited to meet all of them, to talk to them, to work. I know we both are. I'm so excited to be making work and doing business with those folks, because I do believe that together we can change intrinsically the face, the look, the sound, the feeling of the American theater. While I was ranting on crazily just now, because I don't want to leave any name unsaid if I can help it. Andrew Scoville was the other person at Fresh Ground Pepper, and his partner is the wonderful Jackie Backhouse.
All right, and it was Andrew too.
Yeah. That was Andrew too. Was Andrew Scoville? But that, I mean, that's really where I stand with things. And as a fellow dramaturg, you know, I know how to talk. What I've learned and how to develop over time is how to speak to folks, not only as the playwright, but also as the fellow dramaturg and colleague. And what I've noticed, Kate, is that folks are so surprised how non-precious I am in the room. Mm. If I want to cut a line, it's like, I'm here to get some cuts. I'm not here to just maintain my platform and not change a word. No. I'm here to find out what's working, because as I said to you, this is a blueprint for a larger event. I consider myself actually to be just another designer in the room. Mm-hmm. I brought my sketches in too. My sketches are the script. And those sketches need to be adjusted based on the realities of what the room and the circumstance hold. So to me, I'm here for cuts. I'm here for adjustments. I'm here for revisions. That's why we're in this room together. And so once I can get in the room, we fall quickly in love, the entire team, because we're jamming. We're sort of on a jazz rant together. You know, and for me, it's invigorating, because there's nothing like the intellectual and pragmatic exercise of figuring out how a scene really works in the room. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like, you know, different people in our business get their kicks from different things. Some like the applause of opening night, some like a good review, some like a Tony. Whatever, whoever, wherever. But what I like, really and truly, is just cracking the nut of a scene. And when I walk out of a rehearsal, whether it's a workshop or a production rehearsal, and I feel like we got it, there's no greater joy. I feel so fulfilled. Because to me, if we don't see these things as blueprints and try them out, we're not really doing our jobs. They're blueprints. Playwrights, I hate to break it to you, babies, it's a blueprint. And this is the other thing I wanted to say, and I don't know how much time we have left, but I do want to go on this slight detour and talk about Ben Johnson for a second.
Okay, let's have it.
And then I'm sure I'm probably out, and that's all the time we have for today, folks.
Well, I'll still have to ask you what dramaturgy is.
Oh, fabulous.
But tell me about Ben Johnson.
Right, Ben? I think Ben Johnson, contemporary of Shakespeare, mm-hmm. I think did the greatest and the worst thing by writing these plays down for Billy. And here's why. William Shakespeare understood that his scripts were pliable, fluid blueprints for actable events. When we start publishing them, and printing the published and definitive version of a fluid and ephemeral thing, we start developing a literary relationship to something that is not exclusively literary. The script is not meant only to be consumed by sitting down and reading it. Mm-hmm. It is an action plan and a suggestion for a larger event. So what the problem I have more often than not is that sometimes my scripts will read less literary, because I'm not giving you all the answers in this thing, and more as a blueprint and a suggestion. So I look at somebody like Kara Dodds Fetch, who's a fabulous, fabulous master of this blueprint model. She ain't giving you everything. She's going to need you to do some work. But I think what's happened, because the way that, how do we award playwrights? Best script. That means the blueprint has to look and sound and manifest and be digested in a certain way. And there's certain criteria and certain expectations of what it looks and sounds like. Well, when you're not writing within that modality, does the lens of visibility let you too be seen? So my mission, part of my mission, and this is why I love conversations like this, and this will lead into the answer to your question, what is dramaturgy? But my mission, I believe, is to help us within the industry and also those outside of it develop new modalities of reading, understanding, digesting, and consuming plays, both on and off the page. Because we really do have to see that it's a blueprint, which means, guess what? There's a little bit of conjecture, a little bit of cognitive work, a little bit of imagination that we're going to have to do. And if I haven't given it all to you on the page, because I'm inviting you to do some work too, we've got to re-understand and reevaluate what that means. And I think that goes back to, we've got to sit with what? Discomfort and the unknown. And that, to me, is the work. How do we all, both playwrights and literary managers and dramaturgs, sit here and work together in the collective imagination? Mm-hmm. Now, that's not an excuse for being lazy and not finishing your scene. Honey, you need to finish your scene. But what it is some playwrights, and this brings me to somebody that I adore, Eamon Boylan, love them. Sometimes, I read a script of Eamon's that's 40 pages, and Eamon assured us, page length does not indicate the performance running time of this event. Please remember, this is a blueprint. That was on page one. Mm-hmm. And I literally melted. I was like, this is somebody who understands authentically what these scripts are. Mm-hmm. They're a blueprint. We ain't gonna give you everything. We gonna invite you to do some work. Mm-hmm. And that narrows your audience and your readership somewhat, because we've been trained to read and consume in a certain way. But you find a lot of folks along the way that are hip to this jive of the blueprint. Mm-hmm. So Ben Johnson developed a model of commemorating plays. How do we take the ephemeral and make it manifest? You know, because that's what the masks were. Hey, this is what, you don't get to see it, you, the general public, because this was an exclusive event for billionaires, or the equivalent of billionaires at the time. But let me tell y'all what happened. Mm-hmm. It was a kind of reporting.
It was like a transcript.
A transcript. But, there's so many other things happen, and you can't capture ephemera on the page completely. So dramaturgy, you asked me, what is dramaturgy?
Yeah, what is it?
What is it? As somebody who benefits from it and practices it, what I really think dramaturgy is an invitation to help people read, understand, and activate plays so that they can have lives, both within and outside of the theater. I think that a dramaturg is a freedom fighter, a drum major, sometimes a taskmaster, a researcher, a best friend and ally. All of these roles are, encompassed within dramaturgy. And I believe that the role of the dramaturg is to help us find the tools within ourselves to understand and appreciate work. Because here's what we have to remember. We already know, as the great dramatist Aaron Henney writes on the front cover of his treatise on playwriting, you already know. We just have to give ourselves the bravery to sit in the unknown, to sit in the discomfort of this moment, and embrace what we know intrinsically about stories. We all know how to tell stories. all of us, and we all know how to understand stories because that's how we make meaning in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think dramaturgy is that link between what's on the page or what's being presented or what's in the room and our bravery.
I like it.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked about so much, and I still have so much more that I want to ask you. And my biggest regret is that we did not connect until after I left LA, because I want to sit with you and I want to talk Lincoln. I want to talk Lizzie Keckley. I want to get more into how your plays are grounded in history and grounded in fantasy at the same time.
Yeah.
And I hope that there are more opportunities for us to do that in the future, because this has been a goddamn delight.
Oh, I have thoroughly enjoyed myself, and it is so good to be talking to a peer and a colleague dramaturg too, because that's the type of shop talking that I don't often get a chance to do as much. Yeah. It's so nice to be sitting amongst peers talking about this strange and elusive thing that we do that nobody quite knows how to define, but everybody somehow ends up calling us to help them. They don't know what that scene's about, you know, but yes. So thank you very much for this opportunity, and do reach out, because we will have tickets for you if you're able to make it down to LA. Ooh. So do reach out, because we do want you to come and see it. And I would be more than happy to come on air and do another conversation with you when you would like.
I would love that. Okay. Roger Q. Mason, thank you so much for being with us here today. Also, thank you to my cat, Francine, for not meowing into the microphone the entire time we were recording.
Your cat was better than my computer. There may be a couple of dings and things going up on here, but, you know, it just adds to the cinema verite.
Right. This is real life, friends, just in various studio-like settings.
Exactly.
All right. Oh. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And thank you, Roger, so much for being here.
Thank you so much. Thank you.